Tim here, and before the podcast, I have a quick note. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for this podcast. Every song is taken from Simple Minds, Once Upon a Time. All tracks are written by Simple Minds. It was released on 21st of October 1985 on Virgin and A&M. Enjoy.
Where real music matters.
Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.
Hi, it's Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. I'm Tim Burgess, and welcome to another episode of my show, in which I sit down with a band, going through a classic album and hearing the stories behind it. Catch up with recent listening parties with the likes of Cast, Feeder, Garbage, Joan Armour Trading, The Stranglers, and In Spiral Carpets. To catch up on any of these episodes, just search for Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts, or on the Radio app. Remember, it's not a listening party if you don't get involved on social media. So, message me throughout the show using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party, and check out @Tim_Burgess and @AbsoluteRadio for more listening party content. This episode, I'm delighted to welcome back Jim Kerr and Charlie Burchell from Simple Minds to do my listening party. Previously, we looked at their 1982 album New Gold Dream. Make sure to check that episode out if you haven't already. And now they become the first ever returning guests on the show. This time to talk about the 1985 record Once Upon a Time, on its 40th anniversary. Once Upon a Time, 40th anniversary release. How do you feel about that?
I only have the greatest memories of Once Upon a Time. There's two albums that they probably weren't easy to do, but whenever I think of New Gold Dream and Once Upon a Time,
yeah,
I just remember every day, at the end of the day, you felt good, whereas other records, sometimes you had to wrestle it to the floor problematic. I mean, we would have had problems, but for some reason, between everyone involved, producers, the location, and coincidentally, I think they're both the most focused records that we did as well. They're very focused, they're very compact, complete. So, great memories, but particular, because Once Upon a Time is very much the American chapter of the Simple Minds story, and it was a brave decision to, you know, a lot of bands have gone and tried and failed, spent fortunes trying to, I wouldn't say ingratiate themselves with America, but to really go and take it on, work with Americans, work in American studios, try and get a bit of an American sheen on the record, you know, without losing your soul or without losing your identity. And that was the challenge that was in front of us when the band had success everywhere else at that point. But America, colleges and all that stuff was going good, but we couldn't just quite get on, the bigger radio stations and all. So it was time to go on and try and see if we could get an audience there. And the key to it all, of course, he was already well known then, but he's super well known then, was the producer Jimmy Iovine.
Was it Springsteen that he'd done before? And
Tom Petty.
Patti Smith.
He had done U2's live albums. Funny, he had also done U2's Under a Blood Red Sky.
Yeah. Was he based in LA?
He's intrinsically New York,
right?
But he was based in LA at that point, and we told him we wanted to work in New York because we also, we can't omit Bob Clearmountain, who was the engineer, and Bob was East Coast. That was the way it was all, you know, coming down the track at the time, but this thing blew up called Don't You Forget About Me.
So that came before the album.
Well, I did that. I did, Tim. I mean, it's probably a bit difficult for Jim and I to remember exactly when, because we put it off for years and years and years.
Right.
And by the time we got to, I mean, actually, our memory of doing the song was so, you know, I mean, it took us a few hours to do the thing. So you can imagine, for us, it was like, okay, we'll get this thing out the way, and then we'll get on with the record.
Yeah.
And then it went wrong.
We'll,
you know,
get this.
It didn't work out like that. Yeah.
Lasted a bit longer.
Yeah, it kind of took over a bit.
Well, it's through a a dilemma as well, because we'd our heart set in working with Jimmy Iovine. Mm-hmm. And the reason we'd our heart set as well is he was, you just mentioned there, Springsteen, Patti Smith, Tom Petty. Although they had all great bands, they were intrinsically all about the songs.
Yeah, yeah.
And our previous album, Sparkle in the Rain, that had done well for us here, but I always maintained with hindsight, quite soon with hindsight, that with 20% more time spent on the songwriting up front, it would have been twice as good an album. It's a great vibe album. Some fans get upset when I say this, mm-hmm. but it's my Some Simple Minds fans. I feel the second side really could have done with someone sitting on us and making us finish the songs off.
Yeah.
And that didn't happen. And I think I felt we need someone to be really hard on us, because, and I can say this because there, Charlie's in the room, the band was so good that it just plugged in, it sounded good.
Yeah.
And a few, it sounded great. Yeah. And a few words sprinkled on top, it's like, we're away. that's not really a song. It's a great vibe.
Can be a song thing. Yeah.
Can be a thing. But this was, let's go to America, let's try and take the Simple Minds sound, but let's try and really hone the songs. And we felt that Iovine, a bit like a football coach, you know, you get these football coaches that are just so hard on you.
Yeah.
It was time to have that.
Good to have her again.
But Keith Forsey, we'd done this thing for a movie, meant to be a one-off, goes to number one, and the record company are like, no, you're not working with Iovine. You're working with this guy that's just gave you a number one.
Right.
And we were like, no, we are working with Iovine. And so there was this to and fro for a while, and eventually we worked with Keith later on. Keith's also a great, great producer, but a different thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously a different sound than the rest of Once Upon a Time, but why was it not included?
Sheer arrogance, then. That's the answer. No, I mean, we were, at the time, we felt we had this track Alive and Kicking, for example. We kind of felt like this is our thing, you know, this is our, and to suddenly put something on there, it came from another kind of stable.
Yeah.
Just didn't seem right. You're younger.
Yeah.
You know, you're just headstrong. And you know, we were all in agreement. I still maintain Bruce, our manager, should have just really...
Made you.
Just came in one day and gave us a kick in the, and said, right, it's on the album.
It seems insane now, but actually, back then, soundtrack albums for record companies were really lucrative as well. Because when I look back, I don't actually, when you think about it now, you think, no, there would be, all hell would break loose now if you had a number one song and didn't put it on an album.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite like that. The record company in America at the time, Virgin, they thought, and they were right, that the soundtrack would sell tons anyway.
And it did.
Yeah. It sounds so weird to say. It did come up, but it didn't come up in any way to the degree... You know, you might expect. I think for us, it felt like so focused, the record, lyrically especially,
mm-hmm.
and then sticking this song on it, it'd be like taking a chapter from someone else's book
and sticking it in your
book.
Yeah.
I think saying that to Joe Blow in the street, he'd be like, what are you talking about? we're talking about it, get it on.
I mean, the album, the eight tracks, I mean, it's so focused and everything sounds,
yeah.
It sounds like it was done in the same day or same week,
same period. Yeah,
that's so that's understandable from my point of view. And we're going to talk about the album, the eight tracks, in its entirety for the listening party. But it's time to kick off this listening party with a song. Let's play track one from Once Upon a Time. It's the title track.
Long live hope, could spin the whole world round. I'm talking east to west. Well, I'm talking lost and found. Get up to the mountain top. I'm gonna drop into the ground. Well, that's once upon. But God only knows
I mean, I'm obsessing about this album. I've listened to it non-stop now for the last week. And, you know, just didn't realise how much I loved it.
That's great.
It's amazing. I mean, I spent most of the time watching YouTube videos, but listening to the album, I'd not heard it for such a long time, but amazing piece of work. Once Upon a Time, the title track. I'd love to talk about that, obviously, because it's the first track. But I think, you know, talking east to west, talking lost and found. I mean, it seems like, a very inclusive opening.
Yep.
Wonderful synths, a new sound, really, actually, from the album before. It's quite different.
Yeah.
And bigger and
more
percussive, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Over to you.
Okay, great.
Well, I think, as I was saying earlier, we had this idea of going to work in America, but that didn't mean to say that we'd set out to write, you know, some big schlock American.
Not at all.
No,
it's super
songs.
Tight, isn't it? It's like,
and I think the opening track, Once Upon a Time, and the title track, it really sets the scene. I mean, at the time, of course, up until then, the bass player in the band was Derek Forbes, mm-hmm. an amazing bass player.
Amazing, yeah.
Great bass player, who almost a guitar player more than a bass player, but he would use his bass as a guitar. But there had been a change. And then came a guy called John Giblin, who at the time, he was one of the sort of hot session guys. Peter Gabriel. We met John when he was touring with Peter Gabriel. Although he was a Scot, John, he was older than us, so we didn't know him from back there. Kate Bush, I mean, really sophisticated bass player. But the place we'd gone to write the songs, because we used to like working in residential places, because when we went to work, we would just work, you know, we'd work 18, 20 hours a day. So we needed a place where we could roll out of bed, get in and play. Well, it just so happens that the place we rented out in Chessington, a place called Barwell Court, was owned by John and his wife at the time. And there would be problems with Derek, and suddenly there was a position. We weren't sure how we were going to fill it, but we were in there working. John was there. We knew him. Stand in and help.
Yeah.
And him and, of course, Mel Gaynor on drums. As soon as they started to play, it was like, oh, my God.
Wow.
And you can hear it Once Upon a Time, because you have the rock heaviness. I mean, Mel, he could play as heavy as John Bonham and had that. But culturally, he had the groove as well. And so once they started to play, essentially, in the beginning, Charlie and Mick, they would have melodies, but once they would start to play these jams, and Once Upon a Time's a great, Once Upon a Time, the song is a great example of that. Down the bottom, it's really like a funk track. Giblin is playing. We thought, this is a great mix. And then Charlie's doing all his floaty chimes on top.
Yeah.
McNeil's playing these kind of fanfares, and it felt like, okay, this is the opening chapter, hence the title.
Yeah.
We thought, this is a new phase for us. This is a new chapter and a story for Simple Minds. Didn't know what the chapter would be. It still had to be written, but, you know, this sets the scene. And of course, at the time as well, in the context, there was other great records by British artists, albeit different generation from us. Bowie, Roxy Music were having success in America as well. Yeah. Big time success. Yeah. I mean, Bowie had success to a degree, but Let's Dance made him huge in America. Roxy Music, for the longest time, had no success. Then they were having success in America, both of them working with Claremont.
I was going to say,
was that Avalon?
Yeah, Avalon.
Wow.
Yeah.
As we were. So once it got to Once Upon a Time, this sets the scene.
Now you mention, like, Let's Dance and Avalon, I can sort of, like, hear a connection.
Yeah. Sound-wise.
That's amazing.
That's my memory of that song. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, actually, you know, it's interesting you mentioned those two in particular, because My recollection of the entire album, actually, especially with Clear Mountain, was everything was done so quickly.
Wow.
And Clear Mountain was telling us that he did Let's Dance recorded and mixed in 3 weeks. And I'm pretty sure, I don't know about Avalon, but, you know, Clear Mountain's really fast. I mean, just, you know, before you know it, it's not just that you've got a sound, but you've got an amazing sound.
Yeah, yeah.
And Iovine was really protective of our sound, particular characteristic. So he wasn't going to let anything get in the way of, you know, try to tidy it up or get rid of stuff, you know. I mean, it was really, we were allowed to express us inside this, as Jim had mentioned earlier, but the context of working with American guys who you would normally think would probably steer you into a more kind of obvious American direction. They didn't, you know. And I think that's where the album kind of got the sound from, was a bit them allowing us the freedom.
So the irony of, like, what you'd expect from
Totally, you know. You know, because, I mean, like, I was just expecting the first thing they would do is get us to clean up all the echoes and, you know, all that stuff. They did the opposite. They were like, no, this is your sound and it's staying, you know, which is brilliant.
And, yeah, and obviously with the title and everything, you thought it was going to be the first track?
I felt so. I really felt so. I think the first minute or so, even more, well, more than a minute, is kind of instrumental.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So sonically...
Yeah, it's a bit leading, drawing you in. Yeah,
And then there's this kind of fanfare, oh, something's happening here. And I think lyrically, I can't really remember... I can remember when I was singing. I can't remember sitting there. But it was stating their case. You know, we were filled. The record is full. We were filled. We set ourselves on a challenge.
Yeah.
And we felt convinced we were going to pull it off. And so we were already on a victory lap before.
But does that mean that the first voice you hear on it is Robin?
Well, does she sing in the front of it? I guess she does, Charlie. Ooh. Or is it the end?
Yeah.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was my melody, Charlie.
Let's hear another track. Second from Once Upon a Time, All the Things She Said. Incredible song, video, this is like the video, you know. I spent most of my time watching
the video,
your tracks, for years on YouTube. and that video in particular, it's just like
old things.
It's like every gym is a different gym, every Charlie is a different Charlie, different guitars, different birds of prey. Is it a parrot or is it a macaw, you know?
And the time
that you kind of like roll over and parrot looks a bit frightened.
The thing is, there's a term for having a fear of birds.
Oh,
right.
And I suffered from it.
Really? I thought you were going to say that you love birds so much.
No, and I'll tell you why. My dad did. And when I was a kid, he used to, you know, there was a place, we call them Duckett's Dovecotes.
Right.
A place in Glasgow that, you know, pigeon flyers and all that. And he would say, come on over and see my mates. And I would be like 4 or 5, and we'd go in these kind of sheds where there would be pigeons flying all over your head. So I hated it.
Wow.
And to this day, I love birds, but if they come near me,
you know,
it could be a tiny sparrow. I'm like, hang on a minute. Wow. As soon as I hear the flapping of wings.
Mm. Wow.
So I wasn't quite aware it was that extreme. It's only more recently. But I know that because I live in the country, and every time a bird flies in the house, I'm always late to my partner. You mean there's a sparrow in the kitchen? You know, and she's got to get it out or whatever. But anyway, in the video for the song we're talking about, All the Things She Said, we worked with this really eccentric, he was a great guy, director, a Polish guy called Zbigniew Rybczynski.
And he
was just great, but he had this idea for the image repeats and all this stuff. But he had something about birds, and he said to me, "Look, we might bring the odd bird in, you know, and you or Charlie can do something with it." And I was like, "Oh, okay, well." Having just described my fear of birds, when I turned up and I saw that he had a falcon and an owl, beautiful birds. I have, for those who haven't seen it and don't see it, I had to stand with my arm out, as you do. And the thing is, these birds, he said to me, there was a kind of lead on them, and he said, "Don't let that go." And I said, "What will happen?" He said, "It'll go for your eye." And, and I was like, so. And then sometimes it would fall off my arm and flap away.
Underneath these birds flapping away.
Of course, the bird handlers were there and all that. But whenever I see that video, I think, I don't know how we managed to do that. But, you know, that was peak MTV when everyone was...
And you both look amazing. You know,
everyone
so
was trying to... it was very much image-based... I mean, those things as well, when Charlie and I, we look back on the day, we always end up, we still get it. There's still an element of us where like schoolboys were, after a couple of hours, no matter what we're doing, we get fits of the giggles.
Yeah.
And I remember that day having plenty of giggles. I think when Charlie and I saw the video, we were shocked.
Oh, so good, so good.
We loved the guy. I mean, he's mad as you can imagine.
Yeah. And he did more demand.
He did Alive and Kicking also the video. When he told us this idea concept for the video, we had no idea what he was talking about. We had really no idea. But we thought it's got to be great because let him do his thing.
For that video, I think, and it
was kind of really bizarre, wasn't it? Don't know what it had to do with a song, but as Jim said, it was so great. Image-driven, you know.
How many guitars did he have?
Yeah, exactly. Well, Ibanez eventually, because he gave us about 40 guitars.
Fantastic.
And eventually he just keep them.
Well, I love it. I love it. It's so great. And the song's amazing. It's
a good song, yeah.
My one memory of that typical Jimmy Iovine moment was that... So the song was going along great, but then Jimmy came... to Mick and I, and they said, "We're missing a bit in the song here, but we need something else." Middle age, you know.
Oh, wow.
Which is a classic example of what I was saying earlier. We needed someone. That would be the first time anyone would ever say to us,
"Sure,
there's a piece missing."
Yeah, you're not there yet.
That was a classic example of a guy. Because we didn't think it was anything missing in the song.
No, we thought we were there.
I think it would have sounded great to
but
us.
When it comes in, it's just like, whoa. Peaceful, but yeah.
But it was essentially the bridge.
But it was also very typical of Jimmy because he's quite hardcore when he goes for it on those elements about getting the song part of it. So he put us in a cupboard, quite literally a cupboard, with a tiny keyboard and a guitar amp. And he said, "Don't come out until you've got the middle eight written."
Oh, good, yeah.
And I was kind of like that. That was exactly, we came out and that was the whole bit. Yeah.
Wow. What a success. That's amazing. Let's play track 3 from Once Upon a Time. And this is Simple Minds with Ghost Dancing on Absolute Radio. Great anthemic guitar in. In the corner of the world, we'd meet and laugh and drink and plan our sequels.
I mean, by that time we were travelling a lot.
Yeah.
We were getting to, if not see the world. I mean, we were seeing some, but we're definitely feeling
Yeah.
What was going on around, and compared to what's going on in the world just now, it might not seem complex, but it did feel like everywhere we went felt like the place was on fire.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. We would be in Germany, there'd be Bader-Meinhof gang, mm-hmm. and Italy, the Red Brigade, mm-hmm. and everywhere there seemed turbulent. Yeah. Chaos. Lebanon was a big thing at the time, yeah, yeah. as well, and we had friends from Lebanon and felt very close to them and all of that. So it wasn't so much writing a song about all of that, it was kind of writing a song where, despite the background of that, there was still a feeling of optimism or it'll pass, or, I mean, very much idealistic, but... Yeah, I guess you could say it was like trying to write a song about the times we're living in.
Yeah.
But somehow we'll offer some kind of hope.
Yeah. Is that a big live song?
Great live song.
Yeah. Right, we actually debuted at Live Aid in Philadelphia. That was the first time we had played it to him, you know. And it goes into a bit of trouble because it's a kind of a, you know, it's quite a sprawling arrangement on it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, quite a lot of sections, and we ran over time,
yeah.
which was anathema, obviously, especially at an event like that. And Bill Graham, who was the Bill
yeah,
Graham,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
the went promoter. Ballistic, you know. Yeah. But but we did it anyway. And Geldof had a funny take on it about the lyrics, you know.
Yeah,
city buildings falling down, satellites come falling down, and Geldof was having kittens saying, "Don't sing that on this day, on this day of all days. Satellites come crashing down."
That was another great idea of ours, Tim, not only to not put "Don't You" on the album.
Uh-huh.
Live Aid, you get 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Let's start with a new song no one's heard. That's a great idea.
I love ideas like that. I mean,
well, you know what? It
worked.
Actually, for... If you think of the vast amount of people watching in, they wouldn't know any of our songs anyway. We were still breaking through. So what was more important to us was to hit it with energy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And attitude. And we had just written that week or something, and we thought...
So you're feeling really great about
this song. Because the thing is, when you'll know that when you do these events and you only have a short amount of time, it's a sprint. You have to hit it. And it kind of worked. But I think now, confession backstage, what are you going to do? You get 15 minutes, play your three most known song. Now we're going to do a new song that's not released yet. Really?
Well, I love
but,
that.
But so, chutzpah's something, isn't it?
Chutzpah, yeah. So the next song, I mean, there's nothing like it. I mean, it's phenomenal. I'd say it was my favourite Silvermine song.
I love him kicking it.
Just...
unmatched, yeah. How did it happen?
Well, first of all, I think I'm with you on that. You know, just... when people talk about someone, as often as it be a New Gold Dreams song, they pick up and all.
I mean,
that,
New Gold Dreams, it's amazing. I mean, I'm, you know,
alive and kicking this, and I'm talking musically here because then I don't have to blow my own horn.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm talking musically here, and guys, Charlie and Mick and stuff, just. The other thing about working with Iovine is he insisted that he had all the lyrics up front.
Okay.
And he said, because he'd said, even though he'd worked with Springsteen and Tom Petty and whoever, all these greats, Patti Smith. I mean, I remember the first time meeting him, he was kind of scary. He just looked in the eye and he said, you're just all are you lyric writers? You always, you know, yeah, you're going to be ready. You're never ready. Yeah, you're going to have it tomorrow. No, you never have it tomorrow. Yeah, everyone I've met, everyone I've worked with, and I was like, including Bruce, and he was like, including Bruce, you know, you have to have it up front. Then Charlie said they work fast. Well, they work fast because they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
About the odd missing bridge. So this is quaint. Before going over at work, I say, fax me the lyrics.
Right, yeah, I'll fax them, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'd just become a dad, and at home, and the chaos of just becoming a dad, and everything was new and overwhelming, and never mind how overwhelming it was for the mum, but this is a world I didn't know about.
Yeah.
And at the same time, Iovine was on the phone or whatever. Where's the lyrics? Where's the song? You know, send me the cassettes of the rehearsals and stuff. And I remember saying to him, we've got this one thing. It's going to be called Alive and Kicking. And he said, I like that.
Yeah,
you know, and
yeah.
When he heard it, I think he called it a hymn because, you know, when you hear those opening pads, keyboard pads. Anyway, eventually, I went away for 10 days. I sat every day with a Sony Walkman and I gave my myself. I mean, I already had rough sketches, but finishing off every song lyrically. To do that, I had to know the music. I had to know the music the guys had come up with inside out. And I just remember every time I put that on, the world felt a better place.
The world felt
a better place. And I still feel that when I hear the opening instrumental section of that song.
Oh, it's incredible. So when did you come up with the, you know, what you gonna do when things go wrong? What you gonna do when it all cracks up?
Although the way I remember it, they'll argue about it, maybe or did, but the way I remember it, Mick McNeil had a keyboard melody, but I actually took the melody from Charlie's. Yeah. Charlie had a bounce on the rhythm that he was doing. There was a kind of slapback on that, and there was a bounce on it, and I took that to come up with a phrasing, and then I think Mick doubled me. He'll say that. He'll say it didn't. But
you know, that's how it works, though, isn't it? You know,
it's kind of
you
kind of,
then, you kind of you get something from something. It's not exactly, but no, you kind of jump on that.
I remember particularly that bounce being a big thing because
the reason, to be honest, is because and this is what I always maintain about the way we work at writing. The beauty of it is, you know, sometimes you could give Jim same three chords five times and Jim will hear five different ideas, different songs. And I remember when you were away, Jim, and you came across a little jam with us and it was just like rhythm guitar with the three chords. And then, and it was in the midst of a jam and Jim said, no, this bit here.
Yeah.
And I was like, what bit? And it was like this bit. And I was like, but it sounded like nothing, you know?
Yeah.
But it was enough to, Jim went with it, and that was really, really, really early days. And I always remember thinking, I would never have seen that for, you know,
I would
never
know what the chords, I said, how do you know? I wouldn't know what the chords were. That's why I had to say this bit. It's this bit that happens at 3:16.
Exactly.
But what I would know is the hair on the back of my neck would be standing up. Whereas it wasn't standing up 20 seconds
before. Guys, let's hear the next song from Once Upon a Time. It's the big one, Alive and Kicking. What you gonna do when the flames go up? Who's gonna come and turn the tides? What's it gonna take to make a dream survive? Who's gonna protect the kind of storm aside? Don't say goodbye, don't say goodbye. In the final seconds, who's gonna say that? Alive and Kicking.
And it was another example of Iovine again. I don't know if you remember, Jim, we were working in a townhouse in London and we had Iovine come in and said, look, we need sections in drama. So we put in this break that happens quite early on in the song, a kind of re-entry to the second verse. And then, of course, again, he said, he came to Mick and I and said, we need a middle eight, because we didn't have a middle eight.
Yeah.
We just had the... And, he said, no, we need something at Brexit. We need a middle eight. We need this whole thing.
Yeah.
And we worked on the middle eight in the townhouse. And which nowadays, when you play it live and it hits that moment, you think, imagine if we never had that in there. you know?
It's funny.
Yeah, it's weird. That's another example of Iovine just standing on you, making sure you...
So you was know. He with you all the way from the writing...
Pretty much.
So he was breathing down on me. So
you worked in New York and Townhouse is London.
Yeah, where else?
And then the place you were rehearsing as
two,
well.
Two places. We worked up in upstate New York, up in Woodstock.
Fantastic.
Bearsville. And bang in the centre of Manhattan, 48th Street.
Wow.
And Londonton, yeah.
And it was so great to work in New York. With people from New York,
because
you know, when on the days off we did have, they take you to their neighborhoods, and in the case of Jimmy, being New York Italian,
Brooklyn,
and he'd take you where he grew up in Brooklyn and all that stuff. We have such fine memories of it as well.
It all seeps in, doesn't it?
It all kicks in, and it's huge.
Yeah.
I remember one day I must have been a bit down or something unusual for. Somehow I said, it's just not sounding, I don't know, and he said, it sounds great, what are you talking about? And I said, well, when I go back, and he said, let me come back and see what you're listening on. And I can't remember what I was listening on, but he came up to the room in the hotel, looked at it and went, come with me.
Yeah.
So we went in a taxi to, back in those days, this store that just sold every kind of ghetto blaster.
Right.
You know, every kind of ghetto blaster. And when we went in, you know, it was all these big New Yorkers and they were like, Jimmy! As though if you'd been in there every And he was like, let's see. And then we went over and we picked out this big box, you know, you could hold in it, the twin decks.
Yeah.
Which was a big, big thing. And Jimmy had the cassette on him. And he was stuck it in his shop. And he was like, this smile come on his face. Like, sounds good. And I was, sounds great. It's like, take it. You know, it was like your dad taking you.
Amazing.
Then you write, you know, you're high as a kid. Sounds great. I mean, right now you think, oh, it's kind of obvious and all that. But just that whole thing. And
you've got to mention the opening line.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So we tell about the opening line of this. So even though I said that we'd worked on the lyrics and had most of the lyrics, but not all of them.
Right.
And one scat vocal that Iovine had liked, I had sang, You Turn Me On.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as I was concerned, I was like, over my dead body. Right. I'm never singing that. I mean, Jesus. You know, so... The guys have done the track. Track's amazing. And he says to me, okay, you're going to sing. We'll sing it tomorrow. I was like, you got it. I've got it. Great. I got it. Great. So I remember that. And I was getting overwhelmed. The track was just sounding too good.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm never going to be able to, you know, I'm never going to be able to match this. It was sounding too good. But anyway, I was like, okay, I'm ready. I'm as ready as I've ever been. So we go in and we start the song and I came in. But I've changed the lyric. I can't remember what I honestly can't remember what I changed it to.
Yeah.
Something existentialist.
Right.
And it's like, I didn't even get to the second line. It was like,
It stopped.
What are you doing? And I was like, what do you mean what I'm doing? Singing. What do you think I'm doing? Where's You Turn Me On? I was like, well, not Barry White. I mean, I you know. Marvin Gaye, well, I mean, I don't think so. He's, hang on a minute. So he comes in and he goes to me, it's so great. He's got a set of keys. He takes them out and he goes, take them. I said, what for? He went, it's the keys to my apartment. I went, what do you mean? He went, I'm not going to be able to pay for it. You've just blown the song.
Wow.
He's like, this is a huge hit song, and I mean, this was typical Jimmy stuff. Right. Seen by then, I was like, get out. He's like, take. That was a huge hit. Yeah. You've blown it. And I was like, get out. We're getting out. Not take them. So that kind of blackmail didn't work.
Yeah.
I said, let me think about it. Next day, he comes up to me. His girlfriend at the time, or his wife at the time, his girlfriend at the time, had a friend who quite liked me, and I was charmed by her. I was a married man, nothing was going to happen. He said, you know, she loves that song. She keeps calling it the You Turn Me On song. I mean, you're already disappointed. All the band is bummed. The women love it. you've ruined the whole thing. And I was like, I have been, let's try it. And
I love that.
Yeah, we never quite got to the existential lyric that I had in my head.
But at least you got to the second line.
Well, yep. I got to see the line, and it all seemed to work in the end.
Wow.
Yeah, that's just what he was like. And still is.
But he's right.
He's right. He was right.
Oh, Jungle Land.
Well, we've never written songs about fame or anything like that, but I think that is one where we knew we were leaving a certain life behind.
That the kid called Hope.
Yeah. We knew we were leaving a certain, you know, growing up, becoming a dad, corny, getting kind of fame.
Yeah. Yeah.
Profile, things would never be the same. And things weren't the same. Jungle Land was the actual, although it's a Springsteen, he has a song Jungle Land on it. So it's a borrowed the title from him. But our favourite football team in Glasgow back then, it's called The Jungle.
Right.
Where all the young kids went in and the hardcore. I thought, I'm never going to be able to go there again, that's for sure. I mean, it doesn't exist anymore. I was going to say I probably could, but it was a kind of an end to innocence. An end to innocence. I think behind it all, I was conscious of that time of really becoming a dad, and when you become a dad, you're really, it's obvious, you're responsible for somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
You're responsible for somebody.
Yeah, of course.
It's no longer about you.
Yeah.
And so I don't think there's a song written about that, but I think the album is, lyrically anyway, is laced by thoughts that relate to that.
There's like an exceptional sort of like middle eight, around about 2:35, and the vocal sound, and I think the lyric is blood thicker than water.
Yeah.
Does
that relate to that as well?
Yeah, all of that.
And John was great on that, the bass.
Yeah, I remember just playing around with it, and it just sounded epic.
Yeah.
In the rehearsal room. In fact, you know what? We just played it on tour there, and it's the first time we've played it for like decades.
Wow.
And it's more like a, I don't like musicals. Mm-hmm. Don't say you've written one and it's on at the West End or something.
I haven't.
You haven't. But in general, I don't like musicals. I always get embarrassed when people break into song in the middle of a conversation. There are some great songs from musicals I do like, but musicals as a thing, I don't like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyway, when we were going back to Jungle Land, I was so conscious of it being a bit like a musical, especially with with all those voices, conversations coming in, and it could be part of a musical. Now there's an idea, Sharon. So it's a sort of goodbye to innocence. But as I was saying, Mel on that, Giblin on that, Charlie's Lane.
Yeah.
Mick McNeil, there's so many great, great parts to it. And I don't think Iovine had to cajole
a middle eight. That was that
much
was that,
on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you got that one already.
It was about as close as you would get on the album to a standard American track, in a way.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know,
wow.
In a way, the structure, the chords.
But not that bit.
No, that bit, no. Oh, you're right, absolutely not. That's right.
And the effect on the vocals, were you kind of like involved in that? Is that, you know?
Bob would. You know, they would just try things. They would throw your walk in and...
You go, oh, that's great.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
You know, he knew what it... Charlie sound mix as well. I mean, we liked the cosmetics. Yeah, we'd have to give credit to... They would try stuff, and more often than not, they would come up with something that was really good.
So, you know, as well as, like, Jimmy Iovine and Bob Claremountain, you had... Robin Clark
and
Anton Corbin, sort of like helping with the cosmetics. Stellar lineup.
I met Anton last week, banged into him in the airport, funny enough. Yeah.
Wow.
It's quite funny. I took his suitcase because we both had the same suitcase.
Right.
And I took it, and this guy said, excuse me, sir, that's my suitcase. And then that was that. I said, oh, sorry. And then when I went outside to get the car, Anton was waiting in one, he said, Charlie, and I was like, looked at his case, and it was the same case. and realised I'd take his case there. He was great. He was brilliant. Robin, amazing. Robin's married to Carlos Alomar.
And he sang as well,
Carlos,
right?
Carlos was great. He was down the studio a lot.
The thing you say there, Tim, it really was a stellar lineup. And looking back now, you think, well, you can't go wrong, you know. Jimmy Iovine, Corbin,
Bowie's BV guys, the Sim Brothers,
Clark, Giblin.
Yeah, there was a lot of good.
On top of all the heat the band had energy. Yeah, I think. Clearmount, as you know, other positions. We could only blow it. It was only there for the blowing, wasn't it? Robin Clark was, again, we'd seen her on a David Bowie documentary, and I think Iovine, it was with Alive and Kicking, and I'd come up with these melodies. I said, but, you know, we need someone to sing. When Jimmy was a big fan of gospel music and black music, I said, gospel. I said, but not gospel. I said, like I saw David Bowie in this documentary and these amazing people. He just went, well, let's get them. let's get them. Who is it? I said, I don't know. Let's go and find out. Get them. And of course, it's New York. They're only three blocks away. Yeah. And they're all a community with studios and amazing. All of that. And she came in, and thankfully we had the melodies. I mean, we quite often we try bringing in vocalists and give us what you've got, and sometimes it works. But we had the melodies. But then they would give you twists and turns on them and harmonies. And it did end up, through Robin, it ended up with quite a lot of the kind of Bowie crew. Guys that sang on Let's Dance and all that.
Yeah.
It was something that had never featured on earlier Simple Minds records.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and it's something we have kept ever since. Of course, now we have Sarah Brown, who's just off the scale.
Wow.
Good. You know, some nights I'm at the side of the stage, she has her bit. I can't believe I've got someone as great on stage. It's also intimidating. Unbelievable, you know, what they talking earlier of Alive and Kicking, what she does on that. But it was always a thing, you know, we had this blind spot on the earlier records because our Charlie and I's first love, actually, we talk about Bowie all the time, our first love was T-Rex.
Mm-hmm.
And the backing vocals on those records were just phenomenal. And so we got to try and crack this backing vocal thing. Once Upon a Time enabled us to do that.
Let's hear the first track from side B of Once Upon a Time. Oh, Jungle Land.
Oh, Jungle Land. Oh, Jungle Land. Oh, Jungle Land.
I Wish You Were Here, very classy.
Yep.
Wish You Were Here, well, Jim, you could
reggae, Charlie.
But I was going to say, you know, that it was kind of a departure for us because I don't think we'd ever written anything like that with that style, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, recently I was listening to it because we were resurrecting it to play it live again on this American tour just this year.
Yeah.
And I had to listen to what was going on in the BVs at the end, and it's multi-layered backing vocals on that track, even though it doesn't really come across that much on it. And I was thinking about how we arrived at that, because I think I know.
It was our take on one of our favourite artists, contemporary artists at the time, was Grace Jones.
Of course, there you go.
And those kind of reggae feels that she had on some of the songs, we were listening to that so much. And I think it was misguided attempt. It ended up good in its own way. It didn't end up sounding like anything like Grace Jones, of course. But it was, it has this reggae feel to it. And I think lyrically, if you think of the phrasing, it's that I do. And the verse, footsteps, footsteps. It's really Grace Jones.
Well, it is. That is. The verses are.
And that only came to me right there.
I get it completely.
How would we have ended up with a reggae, along with Jungle Land? Those two songs we just played for the first time and
in the longest of times.
Yeah. And they sounded great.
What I love about Charlie, the chord change on the word disappear. So it kind of like goes
Oh, that one.
I don't know how to explain it any better than
it's
that.
It's a kind of a resolve that we never used to do.
A resolve halfway through the word.
We never used to do things like that. But I remember at the time when we did that, when it felt a bit like, this is what singer-songwriters do.
It's really proper.
It was like a kind of a songwriting move, you know.
Would Giblin have pushed for that?
No, do you know, I think that was really Mick and I doing most of that.
Growing up.
Yeah, kind of feeling like, no, we can do that F sharp minor chord as well.
Yeah.
It's a great chorus on that one. Love it.
Yeah. Really, it only came to my mind there, but I think if there was a prototype, it was definitely Grace, some of those Grace Jones
absolutely,
songs.
Totally. Walking in the Rain, you know.
That's the one.
Yeah. Wow, fantastic.
Yeah, definitely.
Great song. Time for another song. It's the sixth from Once Upon a Time. I Wish You Were Here. I mean, just thinking, you know, it's like, is there anything, you know, as big or bigger than Alive and Kicking? And it's like, this one comes up and it's like, whoa, I remember that one, like, floating around my head in the 80s.
Because that was the other classic Iovine thing, wasn't it, Jim? Sanctify, that was, because Jimmy came to us and said, look, we're a track short on this album, and we're, not only that, we're a big hit short. And we, and it was kind of a bit like, and it was a bit like, okay, this is at the very end of the album. And which he does quite, I've heard quite a few people who work with him say he always does that.
Right.
But he came to us and he said, look, listen to this track. And he put on Give Me Some Lovin' with Spencer Davis Group.
Oh, right, great.
And he was like, something like that. We need something with this kind of energy in this. And he loved Stevie Winwood and the whole Stevie Soul side, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember him getting into Mick and I's case about we need something like this. Dragged us across to the record shop across the road. Got the album, brought it back, played it 100 times.
Did he?
And just said, we need something like this. And then we had the emulator.
Lead a horse to water and make it drink.
And we had an emulator, which was a
keyboard sample.
You'd know him.
Which studio was that in?
This was in Vite Track in New York. And I had this kind of mad, very, very processed bass sound.
Yeah.
Thud, like a thud in that kind of a rhythm that we've got running all the way through the track, because there's no hi-hats on that track.
Wow.
And I don't even think there's cymbals on it. You know, when you strip it back, it's a drum machine, really, really distorted, messed up snare sound.
Fantastic.
And a same thing with the bass.
Yeah.
And it's very angular, so it kind of had the electronica.
Yeah.
But inside, he was pushing, trying to get a kind of a soul type track out of it. But that was the underbelly to it.
Wow.
You know, so, and again, I don't know how he pushed you, Jim, but he was just relentless.
After it working really good with Robin and stuff, he said, you know, we should get another song where they really feature.
Yeah.
And he said to me, you know, you should go and listen to some gospel and you know, try and do something that's a bit more, you know, lyrically gospelish. And I, you know, I was like, I don't know anything about that. That's not my roots. And I said, oh, but you can listen and try and do a contemporary verse and try and do a modern version. So I suppose when he would say that to me, it would sound unlikely, but he would plant a seed. And then working on that kind of track, the organ in it and such, I thought, it's all right, you know, it rolls off. Go and write a gospel song. But the reality, and I was thinking, you need a big chant. So he pushed me in a kind of style of lyric, title of the song, all of that stuff. That would have been very much...
Yeah, I mean, a title.
Yeah.
Jimmy pushing for that. I mean, about a year, two years later, he took it to the other extent with you too when he did Angel of Harlem and all that. Well, they're actually in.
Yeah, they went
but
the full
I think yeah. That's what he was. Yeah. He was already on that pushing towards that.
Definitely,
and Our Sanctify was rockier at the core, but it had those. It had a mix of those elements.
And this was the follow up. Single to Alive and Kicking.
It was, yes.
Yeah. Oh, was
All
it?
The Things was the third.
Third yeah. one, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think they might have got that wrong, actually, but anyway.
Can that be changed on the 40th anniversary?
it's all up for grabs.
It's
all up for grabs.
Yeah.
More birds in the video.
Is there? Yeah, yes. There is, of course. Yes. The White Doves of Peace.
Yes.
And that was...
What was that film?
Anton, that's Anton, yeah.
That was Anton.
Yeah, look, yeah.
Was that Brussels, Charlie?
Brussels, Jim, yeah.
Anton was there. I think we'd gone to see some Picasso exhibition and the poster was this white dove and Anton was... it sounds so obvious now, but he was sort of taken by it and... wanted to get it in, became a sort of symbol of that song. Yeah.
Peak video age.
Yeah.
16 million.
Great beret.
So this time I was terrified of a little white dove. Got away from you. Pick it up. I'm not picking it up.
The black and white.
Yeah.
But, you know,
yeah,
and it's the 16 millimeter.
Very, very Anton.
Yeah, very typically Anton. Yeah. And
this is Sanctify Yourself. By Simple Minds on Tim's Listening Party. That was Simple Minds with Sanctify Yourself. Guys, the final track on the album is Come A Long Way. Great instrumentation, rhythmical drums and guitar, amazing chorus again. 8 tracks, all killer, no filler.
Yeah, I would agree with you. That's going back to the opening of the interview when I said focused.
Yeah, yeah.
I think 8-track albums are just great.
So then.
I used to really like an 8-track album, yeah.
I really do. I think for a start, I don't think anyone's got 10. It's 10. Yeah, never mind 12, 13, 14 when the CD came in. If you've got 8 real, you know, that deliver.
Yeah.
And they all hold up.
Yeah.
That's solid.
Yeah.
Probably, you know, it was then, it probably be 32 minutes or 33 minutes, which now would be uproar if you put an album. Just 4. Because again, thinking of sides, 4 and 4.
4 and 4, yeah.
It didn't let up, really. I mean, perhaps if it was 9 tracks, you could have some really slow ballad or something, but it just goes and, yeah, it's so fully fledged.
It's a great drop down before the outro as well.
Isn't it?
Oh, yeah,
yeah, it's
break.
Gorgeous.
Oh,
yeah.
The break, yeah.
Yeah.
How did that come about? Just
that was really just, there's a point when you think, you know, okay, there's a lot of drama in the other tracks.
Right.
And I have to say, you know, Come a Long Way is a bit like, I think, you know, the guitar and the piano on it, very untypically Simple Minds, are just sort of playing rhythmic chords together, and it's a bit messy, but it's, I remember Jimmy saying, Bob trying to clean it a little bit, saying, look, you know, you've got echoes going on, mixed guitars, rolling piano stuff going on, and it's all over the shop. But maybe, you know, and Jimmy just wasn't having it, you know, he was like, no, that's their sound, that's what they do. But I think by the time we got to the end of it, before the break, I think we'd kind of thought, well, where's the drama now? And we already had Alive and Kicking and stuff like that going on. I remember you, Jim, in particular. I'd been playing the rhythm chords there, and I think you'd said, that's a great bit. Mm. Let's have that on its own and then bring the band in.
I think, if I got it right, those chords don't appear anywhere earlier in the song, do they?
They're kind of chords, but I
think it was called Two-Part Song.
Two-Part Song,
it was
exactly
a part of another song, and I think I said,
join them together.
Let's tag this in, because it'll just work. We've heard it all. Need something new. Let's try this in and see what it takes us. And we didn't need to go anywhere with it. It just sounded dynamic, and it sounded like a good cheerio.
We're going over a hill.
See you later.
There's about 16 rhythm guitar tracks on that bit.
Fantastic.
And Mel's doing all his fireworks.
His
roles and such. So it was like, you know, we came in with this, to me anyway, obvious intro, and then we left with this obvious...
See ya.
Yeah. Yeah, so you drop down before you say goodbye.
Yes. Take the pause. That's it. We're done.
That's great.
We're off to somewhere else.
Yeah. And that was the story of Once Upon a Time.
That was it.
Fantastic. Well, let's play that track. It's Come a Long Way. Simple Minds with Come a Long Way on Tim's Listening Party. You got a book out, a joint book. Our Secrets Are the Same. Jim Kerr and Charlie Burchill with Graham Thompson.
Thank God for Graham.
And it's you know, there's lots of
lies.
things that people don't know. But I mean, how did the book come about? Why now?
I was thinking about it. How from when you start a band, you do your first ever interviews, people are asking you, so what's a story?
Yeah.
And of course, you don't have a story then. Well, you have a story about you were at school or you start a band with your mate, whatever. Yeah. But I think there's no doubt that, certainly as far as our fans are concerned, that 50 years down the line almost, there is a story. There's a lot of stories within stories.
Yeah.
And I suppose a few years ago, probably 2-3 years ago, we did... a documentary, which was the first exercise in looking back, because looking back, it doesn't come naturally to Charlie and I. We're first of all, we're not that self-obsessed, and we're always looking to the next thing. But it was definitely time. You could say, why is it time? Well, you know, after 40, 50 years, you've got a tale to tell, and you want to tell it in full details or as full as you can.
Yeah.
The documentary went very well. And at the same time, around about then, Graham Thompson, who worked with us on the book, the current book, had released a book on Simple Minds called Theme for Great Cities. Charlie and I were interviewed for that book, but it wasn't our book. Anyway, it was a really good book. It was much heralded as well. And we met up with Graham and sitting having a chat, and we're talking about how everyone was doing their book, same as everyone does their documentary. How do you do something that's a wee bit different? Because let's be honest, it's in terms of formats, it's usually the same. I think I mentioned the idea at the time. I must have been reading something that morning, probably, on male friendship, particularly male friendship. And then I was thinking about male friendship within rock and roll bands. There's not that many of them, actually. They usually, or they probably are, but we only ever hear about the conflicts and the fights and the falling outs and the adverse. And obviously Charlie and I's story is not that. We go back from being kids literally playing in a sandpit together to being on the beach in Sicily now, 50 years later, and all that's happened in between. And here we are, we'll both cringe when we say this, here we are all these years later, still pals.
Yeah. I love that. I love that.
Still simple minds to the core. Still so much in common. Still very different. I mean, we're not joined at the hip, you know. We're not a two-headed monster. We're very much individuals, but still working. And if not now, who knows when, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
the
memories start to get distant. Things do get foggier. This is the time to do it. If we didn't do it, someone else would do it maybe, and perhaps not do as good a job.
Did you enjoy it, Charlie?
Both the documentary and the book, to be honest, if I'm absolutely honest, the documentary was, Jim and I, just our personalities, we really had difficulty thinking about doing something where you're talking about yourself so much and talking about, we did this, we did that, or the storyline, anything. It just seemed to us like it was going to be a big cliche again, and you've heard that a million times, you know, different details, but essentially the format is the same. But we were persuaded to do the documentary, and it was great because Jim had a really good take on it, actually, which, for me anyway, personally, made it really much easier to get into it. And, you know, and really, you know, instead of being passive about it, I thought, no, it's just important, it's really important. And the same with the book, Tim, because to be honest, nearly everything that we have done in our professional career has really essentially been guided by Jim. Mainly, you know, as an overview. It's always coming from there.
And including don't you on the album?
Absolutely.
That was Jim's great idea.
That was Jim's idea.
Well, 40 years later.
So
finally gets there.
Yeah, got in there.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For everything.
Thanks very much.
Brilliant record. And, yeah, good luck with the 40th anniversary and
good man.
Thanks, Tim. Thank you very much.
Thanks to Jim Kerr and Charlie Birchall for joining me on this episode of My Listening Party to tell me all about Once Upon a Time. Our Secrets Are the Same, the new book by Jim Kerr and Charlie Birchall, is out now. Let me finish this episode by giving you a handful of listening recommendations to keep your ears busy. I would like to recommend Crispy Ambulance. The track's Are You Ready? It's from their only album that I know of, anyway. It was on Factory Benelux. I think it's called the Plateau Phase. And Wind Season would be great. The next one I'm going to recommend is Parliament. It's from the album Rhenium. Had this record for a very long time, at least 1990. And the song I want to choose is Come In Out of the Rain. Been listening to a lot of Geneva Jacuzzi lately, and Cannibal Babies I'd like to recommend. I always listen to Associates. I'm sure Jim and Charlie would approve, but I'm going to ask you to play Logan Time. Don't forget, if you've tuned in late and missed any of this evening's show or want to replay any previous listening parties, just search and follow Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts or on the Rayo app. There you'll find a whole archive of listening parties with the likes of Texas, New Order, The Cure, Bon Jovi, and The Police. So many more. Every song is taken from the Simple Minds album Once Upon a Time. All tracks are written by Simple Minds. The album was released on Virgin and A&M in October 1985. See you next time.
This is Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.